almost gone. Summer's almost gone. Almost gone. Yeah, it's almost gone. Where will we be when the summer's gone? Morning found us calmly unaware. Noonburn gold into our hair. At night we swim the laughing sea. When summer's gone, where will we be? Where will we be? Where will we be?
High atop the hidden bunker in the Rocky Mountains, it's time for Downrange Radio and your host, Michael Bain.
Outside my window in the secret hidden bunker in the Rocky Mountains, the aspen are already turning gold. The hummingbirds have just sucked down another 10 pounds worth of sugar water and have left for their winter in Central America. And I'm your host, Michael Bain, and I have a head cold. My annual fall head cold, which is good at least until February. When summer's gone, where will we be? Indeed, where will we be? Of course, Jim Morrison and the Doors, and what I think is one of the most depressing songs I've ever heard. I don't know. And probably every year on the podcast, it's summer's over with. And I'll play it because I'm like, oh, man, summer's over with. Yeah, I know we got until the middle of the month, but, gosh, summer was short this year. Al Gore's global warming, you know, of course, thanks to global warming, it's been colder than all get out up here. It's been wet and rainy and icky and all those really, like, you know, terrible things that you really don't want to do up here in the mountains. So it's kind of not much of a summer. I mean, it just wasn't a great summer, and darn, it looks like it's over. You know, look out my window, all that gold. It's really pretty, but it's sending that little message of, you know, we're going to have snow up to our butts by the second week of October. Oh, gosh. Anyway, now that I played you some nice depressing music from the Doors, welcome to Downrange Radio, the cheeriest spot on your dial every week. The audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television, powered by the Outdoor Channel, www.downrange.tv, and brought to you by our fine sponsors, Perry USA, Ruger Firearms, Liberty Safes, and Crimson Trace. Sniffle, sniffle, snuffle, snuffle, head co. Oh, you know, I got an interesting email this week. Actually a comment on the blog, on the Michael Bain blog. And, of course, if I haven't insulted you this week, I mean, stay tuned. I'm sure I'll get to it, maybe in this show. But they pointed out that I used to have lots of industry insider information, and I don't seem to have that anymore. So they wondered if I was no longer an insider or if I was too much of an insider. And the answer to that is yes. Not much going on in the industry right now. Everybody's getting ready for SHOT. I keep seeing a lot of new product introductions. People are like, wow, take a look at this. It's like, yeah, you announced that two SHOT shows ago, and you finally coughed one up. You know, you kind of like hawked up a hairball, and it had that product in it. Now that we're past the AR boom, that whole AR bubble, a lot of people are looking at what kind of new products they're going to announce, and the industry's gotten smarter. Like, whenever I come and hang around the industry now, they make me sign non-disclosure statements. So I don't get to leak things on the blog as much as I used to. The cherubs and seraphim have sort of like gags on their mouth. Gags. I know about all kinds of cool stuff, and if I tell you, oh, God, I am so screwed. So anyway, I just thought I'd cover that. That's a lot why we're not talking about those kind of things. But, gosh, what's going on? A couple of things are going on. I mean, not industry things, just Michael things. Here's the other thing I was going to say. I'm sorry, I forgot this. A lot of times I get, like, new AR parts kind of stuff, and people send me, like, it says the greatest new, like, railed forearm in the history of man. And I kind of nod off, to tell you the truth, that if I've seen 15 of them and you show me number 16 and you say, what's different about it? And they're like, well, you know, nothing. No, but it really, if you think about it, it's like new. And I just kind of nod off on stuff like that, and maybe I should be better. In fact, I think that me and the ubiquitous Marshall Holloway, who is, of course, our webmaster here at Downrange, and who works more than any sane human being, we are planning an internet program on new products. And hopefully that will be cranked up within the next 60 days or so, something like that. Basically, it'll be online video on new products, you know, regular ongoing basis. So we'll try to keep tabs on that, and we'll let all the companies know, and that way we'll get inundated with new quad rails, which, I don't know, maybe I'll put them on Alf the Wonder Beagle. But no, that's something that's coming up. Anyway, what's new with me? Gosh, no guns came in the mail this week, which is just depressing. Just depressing. Although last week, as you know, I was up at Blackwater, or the U.S. Training Center, what used to be Blackwater, at a Mossberg Advanced Shotgun event, and that was a big hoot. We're going to talk a little bit about that today, a little later on. Specifically, you know, I want to tell you some of the things that I learned, aside from the fact that I learned that it is really fun to breach doors. You know, that's a really cool thing. I like the idea of breaching doors. You come home late, you forget your keys, ha! But you got your shotgun and you got some breaching cartridges, and whammo, blammo, that's pretty cool. But we'll be talking about that in just a minute, so that's kind of cool. But I didn't get any guns in the mail this week, but I did get a couple of holsters, which is, as you know, I've been on a real holster jag lately. And so, I mean, I've been sort of like buying holsters to kind of try them out, you know, to see if I like them, things like that. And I think I mentioned last week, a couple of weeks ago, that Cedar Ridge Saddlery down in near Tucson, Ash Fork, Arizona, probably has about 6 people in it. That's Don Knox is what I wanted to say, but no, Dave Cox, Cedar Ridge Saddlery, has worked for years and years with Gordy Davis, old friend of mine, and is carrying on Gordy Davis's tradition in holsters. And so I'd ask him for a couple of holsters that he had made up for Gunsight. I saw him when I was out at Gunsight a couple of 3 weeks ago. And they came really quickly in the mail. And I'd even ask, I said, on the dropped offset holster, just for the heck of it, he had mentioned on his website that he really did good floral carving. And I'm sort of in my head shopping for a floral carved holster. So I said, why don't you floral carve the dropped offset 1911 holster? And I got it. And it's just beautiful. Wowie, zowie. It's a floral carving is really, when it's done well and it's not just stamped onto the holster, it's just amazing. It has a depth and a warmth to it that is really super. So I was really impressed. I think, here's what I'm shopping for. You guys mostly know about the barbecue gun project, right? It's a project that's now been going on for 3 years and probably will go on until the cows come home. And they may be on their way. You never know. But I wanted a barbecue gun. Of course, that terminology, which I'm glad to say I helped reintroduce, is Texas Ranger terminology. I first heard it from Texas Ranger. I was down in Texas doing some stuff. And we're talking about guns, and he goes, well, this is my carry gun, you know, but here, let me go take you to the car and show you my barbecue gun. I'm like, oh, does it have a long handle and a flipper? No, it's the gun they wear to the barbecue, right? So and the Rangers were really good about that, you know, really ornate, engraved guns, really fancy holsters. He showed it to me. I was blown away, man. It had a Smith & Wesson triple lock and beautiful holster that had been floral carved and dyed with roses and vines and barbed wire and things. It was too cool. And I thought, God, I need a barbecue gun because, I mean, I'm a famous gun guy, right? So I must be invited to barbecues, in which case I need to have a barbecue gun to wear to the barbecue. So that's how it started. In my head, I'm figuring I'm going to do this. And the way it kind of went from there is I've been talking to Hamilton Bowen about a show. This is, gosh, 3 seasons ago, 4 seasons ago. And Hamilton said, why don't we do a conversion on the show? Why don't we convert a revolver on the show? And he goes, you know, we can convert a Ruger, you know, an old model Ruger into 44 Special, or we could do something really cool. We could convert a Smith & Wesson in-frame revolver into something neat. And I, so I had that in the back of my head, and I went to my local gun store, and as if by hand of the occult, the owner comes out and says, hey, Michael, yo, check this out. It's a Smith & Wesson Highway Patrolman, and it's effectively, for all intents and purposes, new. Those were the lesser finished revolvers, 357 in-frame revolvers. The Model 27s were the really beautiful Smith & Wesson blue guns, you know, from all the way back in the dawn of time, all the way through the 50s. The Highway Patrolmen were the bread and butter guns. So-called, so that way the idea was the police would use them. The finish wasn't quite as good, but this sucker was like new. It had no box, no provenance, no box, no nothing. But I didn't think it had been fired. So I picked it up for kibbles and bits. I think $300 I paid for it. And we converted that gun on Shooting Gallery. Hamilton Bowen converted it. I watched. But we decided to convert it to 38-40, which is a caliber I really like. 38-40, of course, is, you know, it's old cowboy caliber. And a lot of people say, Hamilton Bowen says, in fact, that there's nothing a 38-40 will do, that a 44-40 won't do better, but I beg to differ. I like 38-40, and I think it's because one of the very first centerfire handguns I bought on my own was a Colt New Service in 38-40, 7.5-inch barrel. I used to go out and shoot it with Hank Williams Jr., my bud Hank Williams Jr., and I would load up loads for that gun that were in retrospect, perhaps not the brightest reloading moves I ever made. Because I thought, well, you know, it was originally one of the first 40, it was the first true 40 caliber. I think 38-40, the bullets are .401, something like that. And I cranked it up to 41 Magnum. Yeehaw! It was a hot gun. I mean, you'd blast that thing out, and that was my bedside gun. And it was also good for flamethrower and welting with those loads. But I shot the heck out of it and really liked it and got to where, you know, I kind of like loading 38-40. Yes, it's a bottleneck cartridge, and yes, the neck is weak. But, you know, if you pay attention, you're not going to crunch them up or anything. So I thought, God, I like 38-40, and nobody has a 38-40 in-frame Smith & Wesson, although I found out later Mike Daly from Hogden Powder, Mike Daly, my arch nemesis from Hogden Powder, has two in-frames in 38-40. That's because he has two of everything. So we converted it on the show. And I said, Hamilton, in the long run, this is going to be my barbecue gun. So step A was converting it from 357 to 38-40. So I got 6-inch in-frame 38-40, which shoots like a house of fire, just a house of fire. I did some shooting with it for an episode of Shooting Gallery for our special 10th season. You'll see it first quarter next year. But, I mean, shoots great. And I know it's a pretty sturdy gun. I mean, if I wanted to jack it up, you know, I probably could jack it up, and I probably might jack it up. You never know. But that's step A. That's first step. First step's locate the donor gun. Second step is have the conversion done by a master like Hamilton Bowen. And then I got a whole series of other steps. The next step is I want to get it engraved. Hamilton is pushing very hard for Daniel Love, one of the finest engravers in the country. And I'd like to have a really wonderful engraving job on it. The weird part of me would really like something like, Bill Tigman? The old lawman had a lot of like strange occult symbols engraved on one of his Colts, and I'd really kind of like to do that. Or maybe weird Celt symbols. I mean, I suppose that would cause an engraver to have an aneurysm. But I want a full engraving job, and then I want to put a finish on it, sort of like a muted nickel finish, a dull nickel finish that I have in mind. And grips, you know, I'm torn between two things, and both of them are darn near impossible to get. I'm torn between elephant ivory, which is, of course, the classic grip on anything, on any handgun. And the second thing is something really obscure, Culloden bog oak. There's one for you. Culloden Moor bog oak from Scotland. And I'd have to actually find a guy who could send me the oak panels that can be made, or first stabilized and then made into grips. Okay, for all you non-Scots historians out there. Culloden Moore, 1746, the climactic battle in what was called the Jacobite Uprising. The followers of the Bonnie Prince Charlie, mostly Highlanders, essentially went against the British government, and the British crown finally moved to end it once and for all, and that was the Battle of Culloden Moore. And essentially, the Highlanders were, for all intents and purposes, wiped out. And, of course, I think I've even mentioned on here, I have a very distant relative there, Gillis, the McBain of McBain, who, as I think before, the English histories record that at the end, when all was lost, he was so valiant that the English commanders offered him his life if he would quit the field. And the histories also record that he stacked the damn English around him like cordwood before he was finally brought down. Anyway, after Culloden Moore, the Highlanders were denied the plaid, denied the wearing of the plaid, denied the owning of weapons. And my ancestors, the McBains, got a free trip to the New World. What could be better? In chains. We got to visit lovely, lovely North Carolina in chains. What could be better? As indentures, right? So anyhow, there's a small amount of oak is mined out of the Culloden Moor, and the oak basically at its level in the ground that it's mined out of is oak that was had fallen during Culloden Moor, during the battle itself. It's also called blood oak, and I thought, well, that would be cool. So those are, I'm trying to decide, I've got to decide ivory, I've got to decide bog oak. I've got to make those kind of decisions, and all these decisions involve a certain amount of money that I at present don't have, but you never know. You never know. Final thing is a holster, and I can afford a holster right now. So I was kind of thinking about, I want a special holster, a carved leather holster, very much a cowboy holster for the gun. And, after seeing the floral carving and looking at some of the cowboy samples from on the website from Cedar Ridge Saddlery, I'm leaning really hard in that direction of letting Dave Cox actually do the holster for the barbecue gun, which will someday in the distant future be settled, be finished. And we'll show it to you all over the place once it's done. It'll be a neat thing. And I'm ready to go to a barbecue. So hang on one second. I want to get in a plug for the Outdoor Channel, for whom I labor. I also want to blow my nose. Hey, I'll be right back in just a moment.
Like the shooting sports? Like to see the newest firearms before anyone else? Then there's only one place to be on Wednesday nights. Outdoor Channel, America's leader in outdoor TV.
Welcome back to our first post-Labor Day Downrange Radio. I, of course, am your host, a depressed Michael Bain with a bad head cold, and our show's brought to you, as always, by Ruger Firearms, makers of fine rifles, pistols, shotguns, revolvers, all sorts of cool stuff. Para USA, some of the finest 1911 platform guns in the country. Liberty Safe, America's number one safe manufacturer, my safe of choice after my safe disaster last year. And, of course, Tactical Solutions, fine 22 conversion units for your 1911, for your AR, also great barrels for Ruger and Browning. Cool guys. And also, as always, anything we talk about here on the podcast, that's what I'm doing today, right? The podcast. I need to take some more cold medicine. That'll really help me fog up. Anything we talk about on the podcast, you can go to Downrange TV, www.downrange.tv. We will give you links where to go, so you can actually buy things there. What could be cooler? Oh, gosh. A couple of things I want to talk about that came out of last week's Mossberg event. First is that, wow, I really, New York PD a while back, NYPD, adopted a 14-inch barrel Mossberg pump, 590A1 pump, as their duty weapon, and I love the heck out of that. I shot one in a competition up there. It's got three-dot sights. The rear sight is mounted on the barrel as opposed to on the receiver. A little bit of a short sight radius. I don't care anything about the three dots. The sight was designed to mimic NYPD's Glock sights. So a consistency of platform there. But I like the gun a lot. I like the 14-inch barrel. I like being able to maneuver with the 14-inch barrel. I like the top-mounted safety even more than I like my Remington 870 safeties, okay? Partly because I've got a number of Remington 870s. I was always, in shotguns, you're either one or the other. You're a Mossberg guy, you're an 870 guy. Mark Jury, one of my videographers, could never understand why anybody would have anything but a Mossberg. But I kind of grew up with 870s, and I've got a bunch of them. And they've all been converted to really nice, you know, those kind of rounded safeties that makes it easy to pop off if you're right-handed. And on long guns, I'm no longer right-handed, so I kind of have to fiddle with my 870s when I shoot them. So it's one of the reasons I like the top-mounted safety on a Mossberg is it's ambidextrous. I'd also like to say, you know, if you're looking at a self-defense shotgun yourself, and who isn't these days? I noticed that shotguns are on, you know, everything is cyclical. And for a while it was like, we don't need no stinking shotguns, we got carbines. But shotguns are on the way back. They're kind of looping back because they're basically inexpensive. They provide a tremendous value for your self-defense dollar. The ability to shoot different kinds of ammo, especially out of pump shotguns, and I'm a pump shotgun guy, is just tremendous. So, you know, you got a lot of options, a lot of variables there with that you can do with a pump shotgun. But if you're looking at a pump gun or you're looking at any gun, at least on the Mossbergs, be very careful going to a pistol grip gun. Because, I mean, I know that's tactical, and you want to be tactical. Your friends will make fun of you and things like that. But on the Mossbergs, on a pistol grip on the Mossbergs, you have to move your primary hand to engage the safety. You have to break your grip to engage the safety. That's a bad thing, I think. It negates one of the advantages of the top-mounted safety, whereas just a standard type stock, your hand rests right there on the safety, just like it would on a double barrel or an over-under, you know, if you shot trap, skeet, those kind of things. So it's something to think about there. And but anyhow, before I got more into it, I want to talk about some mental stuff, you know. I want to talk about how I was a complete and utter monkey in the simulation. And monkey is kind. I mean, monkey is insulting to monkeys as badly as I did. But I want to kind of go into what happened, what I learned, and what kind of take home you guys can get from it. But I also just want to mention in passing, tasers. I have not been a big taser fan, right? Okay, you know that from the podcast. You know it from the Best Defense. And the reason is I had some issues on terms of civilian, non-law enforcement, non-LEO liability. So if I tase somebody and they vapor lock and drop dead or they leap off a roof and land on their head, when I had to defend that action in court, would I be held to the gravest extreme standard, the lethal threat standard, respond with deadly force standard, or would I be held to a lower standard? So I got to spend some time at Blackwater talking to Jay Kehoe, who's an executive with Taser, and also a training officer for his own department. And that was specifically what I wanted to clear up, is if you look at a continuum of force, where does a taser fall on that continuum of force? What he told me, and which I've had since verified by other law enforcement officers who've been kind of involved in this, and also Rob Pincus, who's a taser master instructor, is that taser falls on the force continuum roughly equivalent with OC, with capsicum spray, you know, pepper spray. So it is not a response in a lethal force situation. It is a less than lethal response. It is indeed a less than lethal response. And there are a number of court cases that back that up. And, you know, I did a little more research on it on my own, and that does seem to be the case, in which case Michael was wrong. Michael was wrong. You know, if you look at a taser as a left, see, my problem was I was always looking at a taser as a device that could only be used in the gravest extreme, in which case I'd rather have a gun. If I was going to be judged at that level, that I had responded to a situation with lethal force when I used a taser, then hell, I'd rather have a gun because I know that's going to work. You know, I'm 100% on that. However, you know, I do sometimes carry OC. And suggest there are a lot of, you know, it's again, I would rather have a less lethal alternative before I go to my gun. We've always talked about that. If you can use a less lethal before you go to your gun, that's a good thing. It's going to look good for you in court. It's the right thing to do as well. So the taser as a less lethal device makes a lot of sense to me. I'm going to get one of the civilian versions and do some practice training with it. I asked Rob Pincus and Mike Janich to please put together a couple of taser segments on season 2 of The Best Defense. I want to see how they approach it and how we show you how to integrate the taser into your overall self-defense routine. I thought interesting the difference between law enforcement tasers and civilian tasers is the law enforcement tasers are actually tasing a person for a shorter span of time. because all the law enforcement officer wants to do is be able to take custody of that person, take control of that person, whereas what a civilian needs to do is be able to run away, tase them, and get the heck out of Dodge. So I thought that was interesting. I learned a lot, and I'm looking forward to working with it. So, again, you know, next season, Best Defense, starting in January, we will have tasers there built in, you know, into the curriculum because, again, I was wrong. You know, again, I was acting with insufficient information, and once that's corrected, well, heck, let's fix it. Okay. Actually, before I go into what I wanted to talk about, the main part of the show, before I blathered endlessly about the Scots in 1746, before I go there, let's go ahead and get in a quickie plug for Crimson Trace Laser Grips. As you know, I am a big fan of Crimson Trace Laser Grips. And yes, they are sponsors. They are sponsors. But, you know, I use their product on my guns. Gosh, I have used their product since version 1.0. And I appear on their training video because I think it's an important tool. It's an important tool for civilians, important tool for law enforcement. Hang on, we will be right back after this quickie plug.
I've been on the local police force for 10 years now. I've stayed away from different gadgets and gimmicks that were supposed to improve my shooting. A few months ago, when I was at the range, another officer was using Crimson Trace laser grips. I have to say, I was pretty skeptical at first. Well, he let me shoot his gun, and I couldn't believe how fast and accurately I could hit the target, even in unconventional positions. At that point, I became a true believer and bought a set for myself. They were simple to install and easy to use. Crimson Trace laser grips are not a cure-all, but when my life depends on it, that red dot clearly identifies my point of aim, especially in low light conditions when most shootings occur. You could say it helps bad guys make informed decisions.
Get to your favorite gun shop and try a set today. Or contact Crimson Trace for a free catalog at the location of a dealer near you. Call 800-442-2406 or visit their website at crimsontrace.com.
Okay, you're right. I did have to blow my nose again, okay? That was a sneaky way for me to get out and blow my nose again. Again, suffering from head cold hell right here on Downrange Radio. So, we're going to... Anyway, there was a simulation there at U.S. Training Center. And the sim is you're on a boat, and they have boats there that you can train on, and built out of containers, lots of weird doors and ladders and everything. And you've got a shotgun, you got 5 rounds in it. And you're being assaulted by pirates. 3 pirates, 2 with ARs, 1 with pistol. And you got to figure out what to do. You got your wife and kid with you, or your spousal unit and kid with you. So you're trying to save them, shoot the pirates. Pretty straightforward. Gosh, most of our guys, you know, Susie Huntington, the editor of American Cop, she got smoked through it. No problem. Bam, 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 3 dead pirates. Whoa. I got up there, and wow, I'm not even going to say I failed, because, you know, failure has some honor to it. I look like a chimpanzee. Hey, the family didn't get killed only because the pirates didn't bother to kill them. I got killed in the sim. And what happened was, you know, when the buzzer went off, so did my head. My head went from I got a strategy to warm jello. And my strategy went to pieces in my hand. And basically, I look like a monkey. So, and it died, you know. Not only did I look like a monkey, but I also died. Luckily, at the end of the show, I was able to come back from the dead. You're going to get to see this on Shooting Gallery next year. I'm going to leave it in. You can laugh all you want, right? But what I want to do is come back and maybe bring you some lessons from Michael looking stupid that can maybe keep you from being in exactly the same situation. So, why did Michael, who's done a lot of sims, why did Michael vapor lock? And, you know, in a word, actually in 2 words, task loading. Task loading. Something we've talked about so many times before, and something that you know, when we talk about self-defense issues, we talk about defending our life. I would imagine that task loading, workload, if you want to call it workloading, that's fine, is not something that's really high on our radar as a big issue. It's not something that we're going to go, oh my God, task loading, oh my God, everybody's got to learn this. And I'll bet for those of you out there who are instructors, and you know who you are, How often do you talk to your students about task loading? Now, let me explain exactly what I mean, right? Something I originally got, not in shooting, but back in the mid-80s, I started up my very first small publishing company for a client. And the client would say, can you do X? I'd say, sure. And he'd say, can you do Y? Sure. Can you do X, Y, and Z? Yeah, sure, cool. I can do all that stuff. And one day he sat me down and he said, Michael, here's the problem. He said, I know you can do all that stuff. Everything I've asked you to do, taken as a singularity, you can do, and you can do it extremely well. You can do it efficiently, effectively, and better than our expectations. He said, but I keep asking you to do things, and each one of those things is additive. I ask him, you say, sure. You can say no, but you say sure because you think, well, I can do that, and you can. But every time you stack those things up, everything you move and you stack a new task on top of an old task, you're doing what he called task loading. And he said, what happens is you can't do anything well because you're task loading. Of course, I ignored him, and of course, he was right. The next time I really heard about task loading was when I was learning to be a cave diver. And cave diving is a crazy dangerous sport, okay? You're going into little small closed spaces encased in your own life support system. If any one small thing fails, you get not only do you get to die, but you get to die horribly in a sort of a nightmare vision of a closed room running out of air. So cave divers, when in the training for cave diving, one of the things they're always trying to figure out is why people die in caves. You know, constant analysis of what happens to people in caves, what caused them to fail. And what they discovered was task loading is one of those things that contributes to deaths in cave. And that, now think about this. You've got a lot of things to do as a diver. A lot of you are divers, so think of all the things you got to do. You got a lot of gear. It's got to work right. It's got to do this, got to do that. So you're constantly checking that gear. And as a cave diver, you got a lot more. You got probably twice as much gear. You're carrying a lot more air. You're carrying a lot more equipment because you got, in many cases, triple redundancy of equipment. And a lot of things to monitor, a lot of things to be aware of. And at the same time, you're in a dreadfully dangerous environment. And so what happens is if you add to that, you add an activity to that, you say, by the way, could you pick up a rock and bring it back? In and of itself, it's a small activity. However, it has big consequences. Because the more you look at task loading, which is the idea that you stack one task on top of the next task, on top of the next task, on top of the next task, you see that it operates on a tipping point function. Now, this is really important. We think, okay, if I have to do four things and it's all stacked on top of me at the same time, you know, that means I'm probably going to do them at about 25% efficiency. I'm going to do four things about 25%. Because, again, that goes back to the whole concept of we are sequential beings. We're wired sequentially. Time goes forward. Only forward, never backwards. We move sequentially through times. In terms of our efficiency to be able to do tasks, if we do them one at a time sequentially, that's our highest efficient point right there. We are wired sequentially. So it's easy for us to think, okay, if I'm doing four things, I got all these balls up in the air, I'm just doing them at a lesser efficiency. Instead, what you see in task loading is you take task, maybe task A is primary, which is, in cave diving, get your butt out. In the simulation I was in, task A was protect my family. Primary task A, protect my family. And then I start adding things on there. Well, there's the things that you have to add on to be in any simulation. Well, I've got to be able to maneuver with a firearm, a shotgun instead of a handgun. Been a long time since I did a long gun sim. I've got to maneuver in a series of containers stacked up with multiple staircases, multiple ladders, sharp edges all over the place, cramped spaces. I got to maneuver in that area. I do not have time to survey it. There's no way, because let me explain how it goes on. Ideally, I should be able to take a quick walkthrough, right? See what my environment looks like. But I'm filming another task on there. So I'm getting instructions from my director, and they're not irrational instructions. Okay, you're going to do your intro right here. Sound guy's going to be with you. As soon as you see the pirates coming, you cue the sound guy to get off the boat. You've got two videographers with you. You need to be aware where those videographers are. One is following you. One is following the pirates. So what you don't want to do is pop one of those explosive pellets into the middle of the $150,000 camera, Michael. So those are tasks. Be aware of the sound guy. Be aware of the videographer. Be aware of the movement that you may come up on the cameraman. You don't want to shoot him. Oh, and by the way, because you got to set up outside to do your intro, you don't have time to take a quick look at your situation. You don't get a chance to map out in your head, where am I? Where am I going? What are my steps? What do I need to do? Every one of those things in and of itself is small and really inconsequential compared to task A, protect my family. But what happened was that when task A fell through, i.e., I sent my family to some place that wasn't safe, they got caught. Literally, my brain goes, gee, Michael, listen, we're going out for a pizza. And, you know, me and your consciousness and all your smarts, we're going out for a pizza. And when we come back, let's hope that somehow you've tinkered together plan B. I didn't have plan B, much less plan C or plan D or plan E. Although I have taught, stood in front of classes and taught how critical it is to have those things. But that's how insidious task loading is you go, okay, I got plan A. And then someone distracts you and says, by the way, could you do X? Could you add Y? Could you add Z? Could you add those small tasks on top of what you're already doing? And you go, sure. How bad can it be? I mean, you're not asking me to do something, you know, you're not asking me to invent cold fusion. You're just asking me to not shoot the videographer. No big. But it's a task. And again, a tipping point function. That is, instead of us doing all the tasks at reduced efficiency, at some point it tips. At some point it tips. And when it tips, all of a sudden everything goes to hell. That's when your mind goes, ka-chunk, ka-chunk, where am I? That's when your mind goes out for pizza like mine did. That's when you're standing there, deer in the headlights. That's a classic example of how you got there, but that's a little shorter cycle on it. But task loading can get you to deer in the headlights because you got all these tasks going and all of a sudden your brain malfunctions. It tips. It's like a reboot, like a hard reboot. Somebody just pushed your reboot button. And the extra problem is as you're rebooting, you're not only thinking about task A, you're thinking about what else was I supposed to do? I was supposed to not shoot the videographer. I was supposed to protect my family. I was supposed to move around the confines of this with a gun. I was supposed to figure out where my sound man went. You know, all those things pour in on you at the worst conceivable time. So it's scary. It's actually scary. And afterwards you're like, well, what happened? It's, I don't know, man. My brain just, you know, I don't know what happened. What happened was, you stacked tasks one on top of each other. You reached that tipping point, and your brain went into a hard reset. Now, I think all of you will agree with me that in a self-defense situation, the last thing in the world we want to happen is our mind, which is the weapon, right? Your mind is the weapon. Everything else is a tool. So all of a sudden, your weapon reboots? Oh, that's a very bad thing. So, I kind of spent the weekend thinking about this, kind of, you know, how you do with like a sore tooth or something. You just come back and think about it and think about it. And what can we do to protect ourselves from task loading? And, you know, the obvious, spurious, immediate comment is, well, don't do it. But unfortunately, with you know, in a human world, it's hard not to do it. So the first thing I'm going to tell you, and this is like the first step in protecting yourself from task loading, tipping point. There I go again. See, snivel, snivel, snivel. Number one, to protect yourself against that task loading tipping point causing your brain to hard reboot, is be aware from the beginning of the concept of task loading and how it might be happening to you. The insidious part of task loading is it's really easy for it to happen when you're not paying attention. here, honey, do this, here, honey, do this, here, honey, do this, here, honey, do this. And you just shrug it off. Yeah, sure. You know, I'm standing there getting ready to do a sim. I'm listening to the director's instructions. You know, I'm listening to what the sound guy is telling me about. Make sure I don't rip loose the microphone as I'm moving around in there. I'm listening what the sim master, the range master there, is telling me is going to happen. And I'm going, yeah, sure, I've done this before. But my mind is looking at it a different way. My mind is saying, okay, task A, task B, task C, task D, task E, task F. My mind is stacking those tasks. Even though I'm not actually thinking. Here's the key point. I'm not thinking, okay, I got to do that. Okay, I got to do that. Okay, I got to do that. I'm not thinking that. But I don't have to. Because we're hardwired to have our mind do that for us. That is how the mind assembles tasks. That's how the mind figures out what to do in the course of the day. It assembles tasks sequentially, stacks one on top of each other. And then it will do its level best to do them all at one time. It knows it can't, but it'll try. Or worse, it'll skip back and forth between one or the other. You know, you're trying to think, where's my family? And then suddenly your head is like, oh my God, did I pull loose the microphone cord? That's your brain jumping back and forth between all those stacked tasks. So number one, you got to be aware of task loading. And that means sometimes in a self-defense situation, it's going to require you, I believe, to maybe be harsh to your significant other. I need you to be quiet now. We are in it. We are in the soup now. And this is something you need to have discussed in advance. And I've said to my sweetie, who I love dearly, there are times I'm going to ask you to be quiet, and that's because I'm working, dear. Because I've entered into a situation that essentially, we've moved from strategic to tactical, right? We've moved to a condition red. So once we're in the soup, you know, we may have to say to the spousal unit, I need you to stop talking to me. I need you to stop saying, can we run? Can we do this? Can we do this? Because those things are tasks. Those add on. Those stack into your head. I need you with the people around you. If you're a SWAT team, you got to be really careful about this. I've talked to SWAT commanders about task loading. It's okay, now you're going to do this, and 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 you're the sniper. No, you're the sniper. You need to do one thing well. And you need to have someone else, at all possible, handling those other tasks. You can't task load those people. You cannot do it. Because you don't get it, you know, again, at the very best, you get a degradation of performance. At the very worst, you get a hard reboot. So you're going to have to, number one, be aware that you're in that situation and do not allow yourself to be task loaded by people around you. I'm sorry. I've got to think through this right now. I can't. You know, I can't pick up the Twinkie when I'm in there. I can't. If I'm moving into this self-defense situation, I need my whole head. I need all of it. So I can't be focused on whether I can save the Ming vase or not. I need to be focused whether I can save the kid. Okay? So those other things are ancillary. Do not put them in my head. So you got to be willing. You got to be strong enough to say no to that. Because otherwise, you run a huge risk. And then, like I said, I'm aware of stuff like that. And yet, I stood there and let it happen to me. And then I went into a situation, and bingo, my brain turned off. Just like I tell people it will. Maybe I should listen more to myself, right? That doesn't have to happen to you. So first, be aware of it and function. Put it into your training. You know, if you're training other people, mention it to them. Mention the concept of task loading to them. And talk a little bit about how that works. Because you need to be inoculated against it, and you need to think about it on an ongoing basis. So you don't have it like, hey, I can give you the course curriculum, I can give you the syllabus off the top of my head, but in a real-world situation, I didn't pay any attention to my own syllabus, okay? So you got to be aware to not do those things. And the first thing is awareness. Be aware of it. Second thing is be willing to tell people, no, shut up, go away. I'm working here. I got to do this. This got to be 100% right 100% of the time. That's a line, by the way, I cribbed from cave diving. Now, in terms of Paretoing activities, cave divers always said, my chief instructor, John Orlorski, always said, what is it that you need to do 100% right 100% of the time? Train that. The other things, to hell with them. If you don't need to do them, what keeps you alive? And you have to think about it this way. In cave diving, when we look at training for cave diving, the focus is what keeps you alive in the cave. When you look at a self-defense situation where you are having to defend yourself or your family, it is exactly the same question. What keeps you alive in that situation? And when you've answered that, that is a thing that you need to do 100% right 100% of the time. The other stuff doesn't matter. So when you go into a simulation, you got to put your head in that space, which is what I didn't do. What do I have to do 100% right 100% of the time? You can't let yourself get task loaded. If you find yourself moving into condition red, where you're engaging, you got to shut out the stuff around you that might contribute to your own task loading. It's critical. So anyway, that's what I learned from that simulation, and I also learned how to look at a clock, and I noticed we're kind of blowing through it here. Task loading, darn fun, huh? Anyway, hopefully that's helpful, and hopefully it makes sense to you. Because, I mean, initially, the first time that my boss at the publishing company told me about it, I said, ha, you have no idea what I can do. I can do everything, but I couldn't. So, darn, that's something to keep in mind, and something to keep in mind in your own self-defense training, the mental part of that training. Anyway, we're down to it, and why don't we go back to the Doors and just be depressed, you know? Let's just, like, sink down into a pit of depression. Go downstairs, pour us a scotch, you know? Sit quietly and wait for the snow. Oh, darn. I don't think we should do that. Maybe we should just get a margarita or a drink with an umbrella in it and, you know, celebrate the turnings of the seasons because it happens every year. Certainly the old religion recognizes the equinox, the impending equinox, and as should we all. So, hey, the song may be depressing, but darn it, perk up. And I'm your host, Michael Bain. As always, this is Downrange Radio, a part of Downrange Television, a part of the Outdoor Channel. And it's been fun, and until next week, even if it's snowy, stay safe out there.
When summer's gone, where will we be? Where will we be? Where will we be? Summer's almost gone.